Our next speaker, Barbara Spiceman. Spies, I'm sorry. A professor of English at Florida A&M University, has studied the life and works of Zora Neale Hurston for several years. So please, Dr. Spiceman.
Before I begin, what I was going to say, Dr. Foreman, I was at Rollins College 2 weeks ago on Martin Luther King's birthday. And I've been looking for a copy of Zora's play From Sunup to Sundown, and I thought, well, if it's anywhere, it has to be at Rollins. So I've been talking there and seeing if I could find a copy, and they said, no, there's no copy. And I cannot find a copy in Florida, but I did look at the program and the reviews that it got at that time, and they had my play, Zora and Marjorie, was being performed there. And they had pictures of Zora and her attachment to Rollins, and then Marjorie Rawlings and her attachment. Marjorie was winning a very prestigious award, the White Writer, and Zora was simply being recognized for working like the devil to put that play on. And, of course, Marjorie's works are all in the library, and Zora's play, as far as I can find in Florida, is very difficult to locate. And it's basically the same play that she did in New York at that time. I think she kept writing versions of it, but it must be somewhere. So you folklore people out there, see if you can find it. Back to the Depression, the way we started the afternoon. And Stetson talking about the 30s. Well, I'm going to do something Zora never did, which was admit her age, and say that I was a Depression baby. And my folks came from Chicago. My dad was pretty sick. And they bought, sight unseen, some land, now Route 60, but at the time it was Route 30 in swampland. And they had a little one-room shack. And while Stetson was up hooting and hollering in Key West, I was crawling around the one-room shack. I remember my parents used to bring in once a week, we were poor, a box with our groceries. And every Saturday night I'd go look in that box and see if there might be some candy there. I had some friends, and they weren't crackers, they were Indians. Seminole Indians, two little girls, and I remember them. They were Bessie and Susie, and we played with their dolls, and later on I had turkeys, and I named my turkeys after Bessie and Susie, and we had a Tom turkey, and one day Bessie and Susie and Tom were shot, and I was so heartbroken because it seemed, well, I'd never see my little friends again. I don't know where they went. There went Bessie, and there went Susie, and there went Tom. But anyway, that's one of my claims, I think, to being here today. Another is that for over 20 years, I've taught English at Florida A&M University, which was an all-black school in Tallahassee, Florida. When I first went there, and this was before Martin Luther King was assassinated, I was really amazed with the dialect of my students, and when I realized that I was being brought there to teach them to write standard English, and then what they were writing seemed so much better to me than any standard English I've ever read, I felt dismay. And unfortunately, over the years, I've seen that beautiful dialect vanish, because when I went there, many of the sayings of Zora Neale Hurston were still being written and spoken by those students. And I can't say the same anymore. It's just the same bad English that everybody else uses. So my premise today is a little bit different. My premise is that Zora Neale Hurston and Marjorie Keenan Rawlings both had much greater ambitions. So it is a very noble ambition to be a folklorist, a collector. They wanted to be an artist. And this was the beauty about them and their tragedy as well. First, I want to tell you a little bit about Marjorie and how she came to Florida. And I know you know the old story. This may be a little different twist on it. Marjorie, in the 20s, had worked as a newspaper reporter and had had a column entitled Songs of the Everyday Housewife, in which she wrote the most miserable little poems about cleaning and cooking and making pies. She had married her college sweetheart, Charles Rawlings. She had gotten Phi Beta Kappa at the University of Wisconsin. But we have one miserable lady. She was past 30. She felt she was a complete failure. She had tried for over 20 years, since she was a little girl, to publish her work. She wanted to be a writer. She wanted to write stories. She wanted to write novels. Not one published. Not one considered. Not one accepted. She came to Florida in 1928. She was met by a woman called Zelma Kaysen, who later was going to be her nemesis, her inspiration, and finally the lady that took her to her doom. Zelma Kaysen took Marjorie all around the backwood territory of Central Florida, the Ocala scrub country, the area around Cross Creek. She spent a few weeks there, listened to Zelma, and was determined, by God, she had found her material. She went back to New York, took what money she had, bought sight unseen the 72 acres in Cross Creek, Florida, and she and her husband came and settled. She started again to follow her friend Zelma Kaysen as she took the census around Cross Creek. Marjorie listened carefully. She was a good reporter. She observed and she wrote. And she wrote something that is called Cracker Chitlings, C-H-I-D-L-I-N-G-S. And that, of course, is a phonetic pronunciation of chitterling. I have some copies in the back, so if you want to look at this before you leave, because I want you to observe that all this is a collection of folk incidents from people that she is seeing, observing, and then writing about. She observes such stories as a very famous preacher of the time who went to the congregation around Cross Creek, and he was warned that the congregation was going to treat him like a nigger, quote, quote, and they did. Marjorie mentioned a name, Harry Barnes, as being a bad boy in the neighborhood, and that the reverend had left this area around Cross Creek to, instead of staying there, to go to Rayford Prison because he thought that was preferable. And before he left, said to his sinful congregation, "Where I go, I hope you two may come soon." Now, one mistake, not mistake, but it was going to cause Marjorie some trouble later, was using direct names of people. Harry Barnes was a young man in the area. He'd been in the First World War, had been wounded, and died in a terrible, terrible accident shortly before Marjorie published her chitlings. So by using these direct names, Marjorie was beginning to do something that was going to cause problems later on and was going to finally be the reason why she could no longer write about the subject matter at Cross Creek. But the chitlings, if you observe it, is simply little incidents, pieces of folk tales, local color. It has no real organization. It has no real artistic merit. What it does show is her good ear for being a reporter. Now, Cracker Chitlings does, however, hold the elements of many of the qualities that she would later take and emerge into her beautiful, wonderful novels, such as The Yearling and Cross Creek. But first, what Marjorie had to do was to become her own folk heroine. She had to so immerse herself in her material that she became part of the folk tale, a Florida folk heroine. When she was able to do this, when she was able to bridge the gap of the tale, and then Marjorie, the persona that she wanted to be, she was able to enter into what she considered to be real literature. This is the Marjorie as she came to be. And it's very, very different from the Marjorie that wrote Songs of the Everyday Housewife. It's an article she wrote called Yesterday's Woman, an exclusive interview by Lollipop Twitter. And this was one of her names that she, when she talked to her husband Norton, she liked to use. I drew up at the little village to ask my way. Already I sensed the mystic quality of the region made famous by the woman I searched for. A hog ran squealing from under a jalopy, and the driver leaned over to spit after it. Mrs. Rawlings, I asked hesitantly, which way to the riding seat of Marjorie Keenan Rawlings? I knew instinctively that the man I addressed was one of her beloved characters. Who? He said. Oh, that bitch. First I knowed she'd done it with her seat. He looked at me curiously. She's expecting you, lady. She sure as hell will shoot the pants off you if she ain't. But it's your business, 4 miles west. Sure now of my welcome, for I was not expected. I drove happily west. There was no mistaking the place. It could only be the shrine I sought. Sure now of my welcome, I came. The odor of fresh fertilizer was wafted to me on the afternoon breeze. I got out at the gate. A friendly black and white bird dog came to me and lifted his leg against me. We went merrily up the path together. An old colored mammy answered my knock and my question. She's here, missy. She's having one of her fits. She was right drunk last night. Tain't her fault. She's as pure as a lily. She just got 10 down friends, comes out here and gets her drunk. So this is the persona that Marjorie eventually became, and a lot of people believe that when you see Cross Creek, the movie, or The Yearling, that this is Marjorie. However, the real Marjorie is a very difficult woman to find, and I'll get into that after I go through a little bit about Zora Hurston, because what Zora Hurston did is basically the same as Marjorie. Zora, remember, left Eatonville when she was a kid. We don't know quite where she was. She lied about her age so much, it's hard to figure out how old she was or where she was. But we know that if she was not a born adventurer, by the time she was mature, she had to become one. Zora eventually wound up in New York as one of the stars of the Harlem Renaissance, where she played one of her major roles as being the primitive. She was trying to become an anthropologist. She was terribly interested in folklore. She did not quite know yet, I don't think, her approach to the subject. She got very sick of New York. She did not like the New York scene. She did not like being the pet of Von Vechten or Fanny Hurst or these other characters. And she wrote something at the time that was published. And this is shortly before Marjorie's Cracker Chitlins. Zora wrote something called the Eatonville Anthology. Now, the Eatonville Anthology, if you put the two side by side, are written in almost the same disjointed form, using short incidents of folklore and folk life. And what Zora was doing was remembering. She was remembering at the turn of the century or whenever, when she was a child in Eatonville. But the Eatonville Anthology and the Cracker Chitlins both showed women using their folklore and their folk life, but not in an artistic form. Now, what Zora decided to do with her anthology was to go back to Eatonville, to go back there and settle for a while and see what she could do with her material. Now, if you study the two carefully, the Chitlings and the Anthology, you will see the basic difference between the two women. The Chitlings deal with Zora's impression of the black male. This is a prominent theme in the Eatonville Anthology, and it shows a great bitterness. The very first incident is Mrs. Roberts, the pleading woman. She is pleading for something to eat, and she says, "My husband doesn't feed me. Give me something to eat. My husband doesn't feed me." Now, the very next incident given in the anthology is about a woman not getting enough to eat from her husband, but not getting enough recognition from her husband. He beats her. She goes to church, and she sings in the choir, and she sings louder and louder, and she comes home, and he beats her harder and harder. She says, "Well, I'll get my way back at him some way. I can sing even louder still." Another one, which was going to evolve into Their Eyes Are Watching God, is the story of Mrs. Clark, who Janie eventually becomes, Zora eventually becomes Janie, who was Mrs. Clark at the turn of the century at Joe Clark's store. Well, Mrs. Clark, too, is mistreated by her husband. He pulls her hair. He curses her. So if you look at the anthology, which is supposed to be such a funny piece, this is often regarded as one of Zora Hurston's comical pieces of writing. And if you really look at the theme, it may be the dialect is funny, but the subject matter certainly is not comical. And another name is used, Psyche Jones, over and over again. And Psyche Jones, he too beats his wife, and he beats his dog. Now, that's low to beat your dog. But that is about the dog, Tippy. The dog has been abused by everybody in Eatonville, and they've all tried to do away with him. But the dog still continues to live. Now, this is sort of interesting with Psyche Jones. In a class of mine, it was a women in literature class, and one of the students came and said, "You know, my uncle is," she was from Eatonville, she said, "my uncle is named Psyche Jones," where Psyche Jones is eventually bitten by a rattlesnake and dies just a terrible death with the woman just standing there looking at him. Their Eyes Are Watching God, which is a love story, ends with the poor fellow finally being bitten by a rabid dog. So Zora's folk life had a more stringent quality than Marjorie. And I think as Zora got into her books about the artistic form of the Florida folklore, she was revealing perhaps something in her nature that Marjorie always had a problem with. Marjorie had a much more difficult time into getting into her subject matter and really showing her own inner feelings, which might be why she died so young. The two women met. They met at the very height of their fame, when they had both accomplished their goals of being the folk heroine. Marjorie had just finished Cross Creek. She had the Pulitzer Prize for The Yearling. She was, of course, a great success. Zora was on her houseboat, and this was in St. Augustine around 1942. She had recently written her autobiography and had won a prestigious award for that. But the two women were also at the point when they met that there was nowhere else but down, because after 1942, something happened with them and with their work. Now, after they met, Zora, in homage perhaps to Marjorie, wrote a book about white crackers. It's called Seraph on the Suwannee. And this, too, has the nucleus in the Eatonville Anthology, in that she has a very short synopsis about a man by the name of Jim Merchant, who, before he married a young lady, the lady had fits. And so finally, to cure the fits, her mother gave her some turpentine. It went in her eye, and that cured her of her fit. So Seraph on the Suwannee picked up on that little story from the anthology and then went on, and what Zora did was write a full-blown novel around it, but White Crackers. So this, I thought, was interesting in that she used her knowledge of the cracker and also the Negro, because all the characters in the book do speak in Negro dialect. But it's really, it's an interesting book, and it also interesting that it picks up on the Eatonville anthology idea. Now, after the 40s, Zora was engaged in a law trial in which she was accused of sodomizing a boy, and the black press picked it up. This really tore into her, and she went more and more into as a recluse and was very, very hurt. Marjorie had a law trial with her best friend, the lady I earlier mentioned, Zelma Kaysen, who had taken her into the backwoods of Florida. Zelma bitterly resented that Marjorie had referred to her as an angry canary in Cross Creek, and that she couldn't make up her mind whether she should have been a man or a mother. That was basically it. But this remark led to 5 years of utter torment, and eventually went through the Florida Supreme Court twice. The case was won as an invasion of privacy. And a book has recently been written about this called Invasion of Privacy. And it's really fascinating because this is the first case of that kind that came to Florida. And what it did with Marjorie was made it so that she could never write again about the people at Cross Creek. Without her subject matter of Cross Creek, Marjorie again went back to that rejected feeling that she'd had for all those years. She tried another book. It was about her grandfather in New York. She spent 10 years trying to write this book. She knew it was awful. When it eventually appeared, the reviews came out, and she felt a failure. The Florida that she had loved, the Florida that she wanted to recreate as folk life and then as artistic form, was passing her by. As time passed, so did her friends. And finally, she realized, well, she could write about the dead. She could write about those that had died at Cross Creek. And this is what she was trying to do at the end. She had come back mentally to recreating the Florida scene in her own mind, and died when she was only in her mid-50s. So she never got a chance to do that. Zora never quite recovered from her law trial. And she went to Fort Pierce, but the stories at Fort Pierce are that near the end, she once again was wearing turbans and going to a dinner. She again had gotten a white patron to help her, that she was talking to the little children and telling them stories about her growing up in Eatonville, but she was not writing about Florida. She spent the last years of her life writing a biographical account of Herod the Great. So at the end of both their life, these two women had gone from simply trying to create a folk tale and folk life to immersing themselves so in their work that they had created art, to the end knowing that what they could no longer find a Florida, they could no longer find a Zora or a Marjorie that could respond to that material, and that they were indeed alone.